On our survey of places that are shaping tomorrow's cities, we take a detour to one that's bridging past and future. On this episode, Cleveland, Ohio, and its long legacy of converting older office space into other uses.
I like to say we're good at conversions before it became cool.
That's Ryan Summers, Managing Director of Financial Services for Project Management Consultants. Ryan runs structured finance for a firm whose portfolio covers a wide range of project complexities with a track record that includes small historic buildings, an NFL stadium, and more.
It is not a simple process, but it is extremely rewarding, and the finished product from a building that's 100 years old is truly magical.
And that's Bhavin Patel, founder of Greenhouse Capital, a private equity firm that specializes in multifamily and hospitality assets. His latest project is Project Scarlet, an ambitious historical redevelopment right in the heart of Cleveland's Central Business District. And to tie it all together, we're also joined by CBRE's own Jamie Dunford, who covers capital markets and investment sales for Northeast Ohio.
So our CBD is actually growing. It's one of the few in the country.
Coming up, Cleveland and the keys to successful conversions. Experience and insights for bridging the past and future of cities. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and we are here in Cleveland, the home of rock and roll and so many other great things, and we're going to talk about some of those great things today with a group of real estate experts, including Bhavin Patel, co-founder of Green Harvest Capital. B, as you've asked me to call you, how are you doing today?
Wonderful, sir.
Thanks for coming out. Jamie Dunford, senior associate at CBRE. Jamie, thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
And Ryan Summers, Managing Director of Financial Services Project Management Consultants. Ryan, thanks for coming out.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming out. So, B, as you've asked me to call you, let's jump right into it. B, Project Scarlet, what is it?
Project Scarlet is a historical building repositioning of the Medical Mutual headquarters here in Cleveland, Ohio. It's a 400,000 square foot asset, which has been beautifully maintained over the years, sits prominently on the corner of East 9 and Prospect, and we look to convert it to about 120 hospitality boutique hotel keys and about 160 multifamily units with a retail and a food and beverage component. What makes this project unique and special is that it is the first branded multifamily project that will come out of the ground here in the near future. In the United States, I think we'll be top three for sure. We hope to be the first. And this will be a shift from our perspective in how multifamily conversions are done. Because by branding the multifamily, you're able to deliver the value of franchise services to a long-term stay product.
Jamie, B had to buy the land, buy the building. What kind of capital markets activity are we seeing in downtown Cleveland?
We're seeing interest from all over the country, including internationally, overseas, North America, South America. The Midwest is becoming now a real target for institutional capital. One being, returns are predictable. You don't get the ebbs and flows of the coastal markets during downturns, right? And on the multifamily front, workforce housing, which has always been kind of the bread and butter here, tenants never trade up, they never trade down. It's predictable. And then really on the Class A, you're seeing institutional developers enter our market, such as Samara Road out of New York City and a joint venture they're doing right down the street on Boulevard. And so you're seeing groups out of Dallas, Texas come in and buying old buildings, rehabbing even new developments, whether it's the CBD or just kind of our outside pockets.
Mm-hmm. So when I speak to our colleagues or folks that are in the construction trade, the material difference between ground up and conversion is a greater level of certainty. It is the, you don't know what's behind this wall, and you won't know until you swing the hammer. And so that level of uncertainty has prevented a lot of conversion. So let's turn to you on this point, Ryan. Tell us about the complexity of the conversion project versus even a ground up stadium. Maybe it's easier. What's your point of view?
Well, the Cleveland and in particular the Midwest is unique. We suffer from high construction costs, very little inventory of land that's suitable for new construction. So we had to become very good at conversions, even pre-pandemic. We have what I like to say, we have Boston construction costs and Cleveland rents. So it forced our hand into becoming good at conversions. I like to say we're good at conversions before it became cool. And that also forced...
You got rock and roll before it was cool too. So maybe you see a parallel there?
There's definitely a parallel there. We had to rock and roll with conversions before the pandemic forced the rest of the country to do that. It also required public partners, our state, local, other governmental authorities to provide financial tools for that to happen. And right around the pandemic, we were starting to run out of conversion opportunities. So you started to see some ground up projects that Jamie noted earlier take shape to backfill parking lots and complement the conversions that were completed. So I think that's why Cleveland has become a leader, even though we're a smaller market. So we're ahead of the curve. And we're getting calls. We work all over the country, even though we're here. We're getting calls and asking, like, how did you do this? How can you build this capital structure? What do the contractors do to address those scary things you find behind the walls? So the complexity is multifaceted, but Cleveland is a leader in solving those problems, both in the finance and the construction and the delivery.
Let's go to that policy front for just a moment. B, from your perspective, what are the most important incentives that you need to see for a project to pencil out?
Yeah, typically when we're looking and analyzing the project at a high level, it is the cost of conversion, the involvement and the participation of the city, state, and federal government, everything from your historical tax credits down to, you know, CRAs and TIFs that can be put on the asset. Also, financing from community banks or institutional lenders. And I think working with CBRE and PMC allows us to be able to bring that complex capital structure together before you start. And I think that's critical to understanding what the shortfalls are and how do you bridge those gaps in order for a project to be successful. You have to have vision. You have to be doing something innovative, and you have to be able to think on your feet and solve real challenges. Like you mentioned, it is not a simple process, but it is extremely rewarding. And the finished product from a building that's 100 years old is truly magical.
Well, when we walk into this very building where we're sitting right now, it's an old post office. And whoever designed this space did a great job in a historic building with huge floor plates, which led to what I consider to be world-class space. And that's what you can get out of these buildings. The downside is the complexity. And so on that complexity point, I was with a developer yesterday in Akron, Ohio at the ACE Mentor program, a wonderful program that gets younger professionals into the construction and real estate business. And one of the developers said, if I can't get a permit in 6 weeks, this is in Akron, by the way, I'm not doing it. And that was the fastest permitting I've ever heard anywhere. Any permitting relief here in Cleveland?
Yes, they're looking at permitting reform. And they're trying to reduce the friction and create a portal, a one-stop shop where you can work with the different agencies. So they're trying to bring down those barriers and those walls. We're also seeing it on the zoning front. In the Midwest, zoning for distressed asset for conversion has never been an issue. But we're also seeing it in other markets we work in, Dallas, Texas, in New York, places where zoning would preclude conversions. Those barriers are coming down because it's hard enough to deal with the scope and challenges on the construction and financing side that you can't have permitting friction, inefficiencies, delays get in the way of moving these projects forward. So we are seeing our public partners being proactive. I think there's a lot of work to be done, but we're seeing less and less where a zoning, a height, an air rights, a building permit delay is getting in the way of these projects. Right now, it's about capital and macroeconomics.
What are the biggest lessons that other cities can learn from Cleveland in conversions?
I think if you could educate the public partners on what is needed to execute on a project from start to finish. We've talked about reducing friction with entitlements and zoning, different programs that from a financial incentive standpoint, you really want to take a roadmap and educate at all levels. Another one is having the contractors that have experience. If there is a market that doesn't have contractors that are experienced in this complex office conversion redevelopments, bring the contractor with you. B is working with a firm. They're called Cleveland Construction. It's a little bit of a misnomer because they work all over the country. And they are doing some of the biggest conversions outside of Cleveland. Have the right team. You need to build a team. It's not just your lawyers and architects. It's your contractor. It's a lobbyist that can educate your public partners. So you really want to build a team and have a roadmap and have it be portable. Texas is a perfect example. They created an uncapped state historic tax credit. We are fortunate to work on the largest historic redevelopment in the state of Texas. And it took really smart people from outside Texas to come in, roll up their sleeves and say, here's how we can help the local contractor, governmental authorities to get to the finish line.
I think Ryan did a great job of explaining the team approach. It takes a team and extreme expertise in what you're doing. As we had alluded to earlier, no two buildings are going to be the same. They all have their challenges. So you absolutely have to have a construction partner that has the depth and the breadth of knowledge to be able to face those challenges and overcome them. Nothing is impossible, right? Time and money solve all challenges, but having a good team will help you execute that project.
It's from architects to bankers to legal to GCs to the right incentives groups. And also, what is your exit eventually? Is it a refi and hold in forever? Or, hey, I'm going to engage with a broker now. Here's my pro forma development, right? Here's my lease up. Here's my stabilization. You've got to kind of look at it from every different angle possible.
I think community involvement and engagement is critical. Whichever community that you do a project in, right, you have to be involved. You have to understand the local norms, the customs, the pain points, and help solve for those. Like, we always think about being a value add to wherever we do a project. We like to improve the area that we're in and have a long-term commitment to it.
So let's turn to you now, Jamie, and talk about what do people say when they're coming to Cleveland? It's like, well, this is the opportunity. This is the challenge. Tell us what the investor mindset is.
So they pretty much know why, right? Mm-hmm. That's the question I get all the time is why Cleveland? Why am I looking here? Well, one, our market's on fire, in my opinion, especially on the residential side. We've delivered probably north of 5,000 units since 2020. Cleveland proper, they've all been stabilized. We're still north of 95% on Class A properties in the CBD on occupancy, which is pretty remarkable. Two, we have a housing shortage here. That's going to stay that way for the next 10 plus years. Quite frankly, it's just not going to change. As much as we want it to change, it's just not feasible this time, especially with construction starts that have kind of just halted when we saw construction interest rates go from pretty much 2% to 8% in a matter of 6 months in 2022 to 2023. But really, you know, the number one kind of thesis is rent growth. One, it's cheaper to rent than it is to buy. Two, we're number three in the country right now in terms of rent growth. Projected to be number two for the next 5 years going forward. It's real. And you see the jobs that are coming here. Sherwin-Williams has doubled down on the CBD with their new headquarters. You know, we have some of the highest concentration of Fortune 500 companies in Northeast Ohio. So professional services combined with our eds and meds, right? We call that University Circle District, Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital, Case Western Reserve. That's the key drivers here.
B, let's expand on that point because we were talking before the show about what are the economic drivers. And I'd like to hear from your perspective what they are. And let's talk about the broader picture with manufacturing and otherwise.
The key drivers can be broken down into three categories: professional services, legacy manufacturing that is being transformed into manufacturing 4.0, as we like to call it. And then finally, oil and gas on a regional perspective. And the professional services, finance, insurance, hospitals, and company HQs are big drivers for our economy. On the manufacturing side, steel production is being refined dramatically. Cliffs is leading the charge in that. A lot of hydrogen that is going to be used to create cutting-edge technologies that will produce steel at a low emissions level. Tool manufacturing and things like that from the legacy manufacturing side. On the oil and gas, the resurgence of fracking, the transformation and the pivot from coal-fired power plants to natural gas, and then all of the energy expansion that brings due to downstream polymer production, I think is going to be a great tailwind. Jamie made a wonderful point about housing shortage. One of the key statistics in the state of Ohio is that we're the seventh largest by population in the United States, but 40th by new home starts. So therefore, this conversion of legacy office space to multifamily has a higher demand factor and a need here. And I think public-private partnerships, local city to state governments really feel the pressure of providing more housing. And therefore, I think it enables a lot of these initiatives, streamlining of operations between permitting and zoning and things like that.
B, let's get into the financing of how this stuff actually works. I'm going to start with just a very basic concept and you walk me through if this is correct and how we get there, that most developers will not touch a ground-up multifamily development deal. The number used to be a 6% yield on cost. I think it's now moved up to 7 or 8%. What's the number for conversions? How do you get there?
So it depends on the size of the project, right? We don't believe that under 100 units is feasible. I think you have to have enough scale. Second is condition of the project. As you mentioned earlier, it is so specific. In ground-up construction, you can generalize based on land cost, construction costs, permitting costs, all of these things. In a conversion, it is very asset-specific. The condition of the asset will drive almost everything. And then the historical nature of it. What will the preservation authorities want you to keep, move? How much structural engineering is going to be involved into repurposing of it? If you're building a parking garage inside of a building, well, what kind of restructuring has to be done there? So I can't give you a specific answer that's broad to the industry, but for our project, I think we have found an asset that is in a terrific condition that allows our numbers to work from a hospitality, multifamily, like hospitality, multifamily combination perspective. If we try to do in a 400,000 square feet, all multifamily, the cash flow wouldn't justify it. If we had tried to do 300 plus hotel keys, the cap rate wouldn't have justified the deal. The combination of the two, I believe, is the winner. And I think that's why it differentiates itself as a project in this market.
Banks look very differently at apartment projects than they do at hotel projects. How do you get them comfortable with doing both at the same time?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the operator. We at Green Harvest Capital own and operate 1,500 multifamily units in Northeast Ohio, and our Spark GHC brand operates 1,700 hospitality units throughout the Mid-Atlantic. And we have deep expertise in operating both and owning both. And so when we are talking to a lender, they look at us as a group that can understand the challenges and the cyclical nature of hospitality and how to differentiate yourself, because that's a critical component to driving ADR and occupancy, along with the multifamily servicing side and understanding the market. So we're not over anticipating square foot rents or underestimating operating expenses, which is a big mistake that a lot of developers do.
Are you getting one loan for the entire project?
We've gone out to 120 lenders, and we'll have an acquisition loan that will be a community bank. Behind it, the development and the construction loans will be a combination of 2 to 3 banks that will co-participate.
And Spencer, I look at this as silos. You have to take a complex project and silo the different asset classes. And we actually work backwards. We give B and our clients information based on each level of government incentive we can secure to buy down our costs so he can achieve a yield on cost. So if we think we need to have a 300 basis point spread or a 3% spread on hospitality to give B and his investors room on that revenue because it might have a higher cap rate, we'll then work backwards. These are the incentives, and that silo will require additional incentives to get to that yield on cost versus multifamily. We'll trade off a current permanent financing rate that today, luckily, is now in the mid-5s. So that becomes a much easier swing.
And just so our listeners understand, that rate was mid-7s 18 months ago?
And yeah.
If you could even get it.
Yes, if you could get it. So we silo it and we work backwards. We actually reverse engineer the yield on cost based on what B and his investors' requirements in the both return on capital from their equity side and the monies and NOI needed to service their debt.
So how transparent is the financing, the math, to the government authorities? And when you go to them and they say, hey, I love the project, it's beautiful, but it's going to cost me X percent more than the next one. I can't do it.
It has to be transparent because their return on investment is not the same as what B and his investors need in terms of cash flow. Their ROI are jobs, economic impact, incremental taxes, putting an asset that's out of service in service. So what we do is recreate that story, just like B creates a story to his bank and his investors. But that story is ROI based on economic and positive economic input, output, and why they want to support the project and make that investment.
So I was walking here from my hotel this morning. By the way, one of the things I liked about Cleveland, almost everything's within walking distance here. And I did walk past the lake. I don't think the lake has ever been more valuable than it is right now. What's your point of view on that?
It's our best natural resource. I mean, it's our number one advantage. And Cleveland has a long-term vision of, I would say, activating and enhancing the lake and what it can offer to its residents. I would say come back in 10 years, it's going to look vastly different.
Well, it already looks pretty vastly different from the 25 years ago. But I think the fact that you've got so much fresh water is going to help data centers. It's going to help all forms of manufacturing that are heavy water users, which frankly are most of them. So do we see that as a big driver in the future?
Absolutely. I think energy costs are going to drive a lot of investment into Ohio. Wages, even though Ohio is seventh largest by population, we're median household incomes are in the 60s here. National average is 70s. So I think you're going to find a skilled workforce here that can be utilized. Also, cost of land, cost of construction isn't always in parity, but it's still quite good. And the natural resources, the logistics management, the ability to get from New York to Chicago, down from Kentucky up, and going to Atlanta, I think those are just vital assets for Ohio. We're like at the crossroads of it.
Jamie, you mentioned that 10 years now, it's going to look a whole lot different. The population of the downtown area is actually increasing, which is something that I think will come as a surprise to a lot of our listeners. What's your point of view?
Our CBD is actually growing. It's one of the few in the country. 2,000 residents living downtown to now we're at 21,000, mm-hmm. right? That was from 2003 to today. And it's driven by a few things. One of recent college graduates, they crave that urban living environment. They want to live, work, and play. They want to walk to work. They want to go out with their friends afterwards. They want to entertain on the weekends. They don't want to live at home with mom and dad, right? Our rents have always been cheap enough where they can achieve that right out of college. That's still doable today. Additionally, we've got three kind of sub-markets right around us. You've got Tremont, you've got Ohio City, you've got Gordon Square. Those three markets are on fire with all new construction, whether it's multifamily, condos, and they're all walkable neighborhoods with little pockets of restaurants, retail, things to do. And so combined, you've seen, I mean, absolutely explosive growth in the last, call it, 15 years.
Now, there have been areas in Cleveland that used to have a more checkered reputation. The Flats is the one that 30 years ago was a very different place than it is today. But today it has some of the nicest, newest product there, complete transformation. Any comment on that?
It's pretty wild. What was done, this was delivered in 2013. It's 950 Main Avenue. Now it's called the Oswald Building. Then you have the Flats at East Bank Apartments. And you've got another 100,000 square feet of retail and restaurants below that. And you've got entertainment all along the riverfront there as well, with plans to expand on it.
Let's talk now a little bit more about labor and the schools here. The challenge isn't having great schools here. The challenge is keeping the students here after they leave. Any point of view on that?
As a model, I think as we look at Columbus and Ohio State, 40% of graduates from Ohio State stay in Columbus. That is the driving engine of that city, right? That is the labor, that is the intellectual property. I think Cleveland is a very similar story. I think the one strategic advantage that Cleveland has is our clinic. Cleveland Clinic, founded 1921 by four visionary physicians. They took a combined education and research approach, which allowed innovation to foster and built the second largest hospital system in the world. And I think leaning into that is key for our education system to continuously, one, produce high-level graduate degrees and then retain them, make them part of our ecosystem.
Yes, for sure. And kind of in that University Circle area between the clinic and UH, you know, university hospitals, they're spending, I think, $3 or $4 billion for the next couple of years on new programs, buildings, that's going to create 10,000, 20,000 jobs. It's fascinating.
B, let's talk about the rest of your portfolio for a moment and how it informs you for what you may be doing here in Cleveland. I understand you own over 1,000 multifamily units, or own and manage, and similar in the hotel space on the Eastern Seaboard. Tell us a little bit about that and what the lessons you've learned there and how it can work for Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, majority of our multifamily here is in Northeast Ohio, and we own and operate it. We're vertically integrated. We have our own capital formation arm, our own property management arm, and our own construction services arm. And we've learned a lot of lessons about efficiencies, integration of IoT devices, cloud-based property management systems that help us deliver a better experience for our tenant. On the hospitality side, you know, hospitality is going through a transition. Airbnb has redefined what it means to have a short-term rental. And so there is a large demographics shift occurring in the hospitality business. Up to 70% of all hotel motels in this country are Indian origin owned. And a lot of those owners are baby boomers. Like other industries, there's a transition from the older ownership to more private equity model, more of a scale model than one and two operatorship. And then the convergence of the two, we're seeing, I think it's the first time in 100 years, where multifamily will be branded. And just like Howard Johnson back in the day started branding motels along our highways, at this point, multifamily branding could be the next way to franchise all over the country.
What's going on in the rest of the market, industrial, office, any thoughts there?
So industrial is still white hot, right? So I can tell you from investors' interest, the two asset classes that are of most flavor remains industrial, multifamily. I believe our industrial vacancy rate in Northeast Ohio is 2 or 3% right now. Mm-hmm. It's shockingly low. And that's north of 50 million square feet of inventory. The office market is better than what people realize. The headlines are a little bit misleading. Sure, in Cleveland, it's not an institutional market for office. But if you look at our Class A and our trophy assets here are 95 and 96% leased respectively. Our Class A combined is probably 10% vacancy, 11% vacancy.
And you're defining Class A as what?
It's a mix of level of rents versus finishes versus experience you're going to get.
Because you have in this downtown area, there's probably four towers that are a million square feet each. They're big.
Correct.
And are those Class A in your opinion?
They are. And you ask any broker, they're going to give you a different answer, right? It's what kind of rents are they charging? What kind of amenities do they have?
What kind of rents are you charging?
So for Class A, you're going to see anywhere from 28 to 35 a square foot.
That's gross.
Modified gross with the base year. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we peak at in this market. Now your Class B, you're going to get anywhere from Class B to B plus, call it 20 to 25. And then normal Class B, you're going to be high teens to low 20s. You know, the one thing about our Cleveland market is, and this is what's unfortunate, we haven't had real rent growth in about 30 years from the office side. When you adjust for inflation, it's actually flat. And so we actually think rent growth is going to occur here pretty, you know, in short order. For the main reason being expenses have gone up, rents have to go up, or else things are upside down.
Let's turn to you, Ryan, now for a moment. I want to just be a little bit more granular on the types of incentives you think are most important. And you mentioned the flats deal, so you could probably have an entire program, a book written about that one. But what are the incentives that you think are most impactful to get developers to convert buildings, whether they be tax, historic, whether they be permitting relief or otherwise?
So, Spencer, we've been fortunate to be a part of converting 3,174 units in.
Let's not be too specific here.
In our CBD, and the most important incentive at this juncture are the ones that bridge the second tier gap. First tier gap is what your traditional incentives are: state historic tax credit and. 70% of the states in the country have some sort of state historic tax credit program. And the federal program, which is as of right and uncapped and has been around since the early 80s, the secondary financial gap programs are the ones that we need additional money over our historic credits, our debt, and our equity. So what we have to do to help our clients, we become the financial quarterback. And we go and we will meet with the various levels of government and say, these traditional incentives are not enough today. And we don't see them being enough in any market. So we either have to create an incentive, come up with a non-programmatic ask. This is a tax increment financing idea. This is a brownfield grant that may or may not exist. This is a rebate of income taxes, and recreate that idea and turn it into money so we can get to a financial closing for our clients. And we will port those ideas throughout the country. It might be called something else. It might have some other complex increment, you know, name, but it's essentially the same thoughts and ideas to bridge that second level of gap, because it just doesn't work with a traditional bucket of incentives. So getting to deal feasibility and that yield and cost that you and B were talking about earlier takes that additional lift. And what we do is we come up with this initial incentive strategic plan that has those additional incentives. So those are the key right now. I think you'll see less reliance on those if the cost of capital continues to trend down, and hopefully construction costs stabilize or go down. That's less likely in our view and what we're seeing in all different markets. But we're working in different markets, and it's just a different level of financing gap. We have a very big project in downtown Dallas, Texas. We're working on projects in Midtown Manhattan, and they all have that we're going to take advantage of the traditional programs, but PMC Finance, how do you help us come up with these ideas and strategies? And it's oftentimes a square peg in a round hole, and you have to create the story to get the public partner to buy in. We're seeing a lot of buy-in, but it's not easy. It takes time. It takes the financial support. It takes the transparency. Here's why the deal doesn't work. And it'll probably take two or three different programs to solve that gap with the traditional debt, equity, and tax credits.
These projects take time. You have to have the ability to withstand the buildup to the project. There are a lot of costs that are incurred before closing occurs on the asset, financial closing occurs, and debt partners come to the table. It comes down to relationships and markets. I think you have to have a great track record in the market that you would like to do something in. This is more of an art than a science when you're dealing with historical repositioning of assets. You have to have a pain threshold that's higher than others, and you have to believe and have a vision that is going to withstand the ebbs and flows of the economic cycle. And I think all of those things are critical in order for you to bring a project together and then work from a quarterly basis, meet those challenges head on, and work with professionals. So for us, on this particular project, CBRE is a great partner. They help us find and put this project together. And I remember when Jamie called first time and said, this is a legacy project. This will define your organization in Cleveland. Are you ready to take it on? And it's going to be difficult, it's going to be challenging, and it's going to take time. We reached out to PMC early on. Walter Haverfield is our law firm. We're working with Cleveland Construction as our construction GC. We're doing a design build concept. They've built 18 buildings in this market. And then we've worked extensively with Ryan and team to understand the primary funding gap and then the secondary funding gap. So from a debt partner perspective, again, it'll be a group of community banks that will come together, form a coalition for this project, acquisition financing, and then the construction financing. From the investor side, we as an organization have over 300 investing entities. We communicate with around 1,000 across the United States. And what we've done is we've formed a track record of delivering a double-digit IRR through multiple cycles, through multiple asset classes. So they look to us to say, okay, tell us how much capital have we deployed with you that's earning a great yield. Give us your track record on successful exits of projects, and then help us understand how we can invest with you over the next 2 to 5 years. We truly believe in the convergence of hospitality and multifamily as the new investment criteria for us and our investors.
Let's just go around the horn, and I'm going to ask Ryan just a direct question. You mentioned the number of units that are done here in Cleveland, over 3,000. You've got your wonderful Project Scarlet going on now, which is going to add to that. We're going to have this podcast again 5 years from now. How many converted units do you expect in Cleveland?
I think it's realistic to get to a population of 30,000. So we can get to that number. And I've thought about, not every building should be converted, Spencer. We don't want every building converted. We want, but those buildings that aren't converted need to be better. They need to be the Class A. You alluded earlier to that building, San Antonio. That's a flight to quality, in my opinion. So you're going to have to improve the buildings that aren't well occupied, invest in your Class A office space, and then everything behind it should be converted or converted to a park, which might mean being torn down. So you have to have a plan. The good news here is that we are a clustered CBD, so it's easy to identify and map out a plan. It may not be quick. There could be buildings that are in special servicing. There could be owners that are unwilling to cooperate, but eventually it's going to get there. It's like gravity. So you will get there. Our plan, I think, that we should focus on is investing in the office buildings and making them, bringing them up to a flight to quality, converting the ones that don't meet that criteria.
Getting to 30,000 in 5 years is an ambitious plan, but that's possible.
Well, we had 30,000 residents. Right now, we're just over 20,000. So we think it's achievable. And B's project alone is going to bring, you know, 400 or 500 plus the business travelers. So big projects like Project Scarlet are going to make a dent in that goal. And I think it is absolutely achievable.
Jamie, final thoughts from you. What's your vision 5 years from now for Kirkland?
It's going to look vastly different. A couple of things. One, Project Scarlet, there's other additional assets on the market that I've got listed today that are under contract that are going to be conversions, right? One is the historic Rockefeller building right across from Sherwin-Williams headquarters. Two, I'd say, look at what Bedrock's doing along the riverfront, right? That's a $4 billion development on 140 acres facing the waterfront. Mm-hmm. That's a 10 to 15 to 20 year project. The city of Cleveland is determined to unlock the value of the lake, build that land bridge, create public-private partnerships, public spaces for residents. The county is moving the justice center and the jail. That's their plan, right? And so that's going to create a pretty large area right smack in the middle of the CBD that's going to be ripe for development, whether it's office, hotels, condos, you name it. So I would say you come back here in 5 years, it's going to look vastly, vastly different in terms of population growth, new product, new development, and jobs, quite frankly.
Well, on behalf of the Weekly Take, what a great conversation today. I first want to thank Bhavin Patel, B, and thank you for letting me call you B, co-founder of Green Harvest Capital, for telling us about Scarlet, Project Scarlet, and some of the great things they're doing around the country. Thanks so much for coming out today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I then want to thank my colleague, Jamie Dunford, senior associate at CBRE, for being a big part of Project Scarlet and all of the great work you do here in the city.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And then Ryan Summers, managing director of financial services, project management consultants, for the work you do here in Cleveland and everywhere, and keep rocking. And I can say that sincerely, take the best practices from one city, bring it here, bring it there, because that's what we need.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you, Spencer.
For related content and more information, check out our website, cbre.com/theweeklytake. And make sure you take advantage of the Talk to Us button to share your feedback or any question or topics you'd like us to address. In the weeks to come, we'll continue our series of conversations about the future of cities with visits to other markets that are setting trends. This includes trips to the outskirts of our nation's capital to hear what's going on in Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, as well as the influential developments and strategies that we're seeing on the ground in New York, Dallas, Atlanta, and more. You can find our special report, Shaping Tomorrow Cities, at cbre.com/insights. And even as we look to the future, we'll also keep an eye on the state of sectors across the industry right now. To that end, we'll be back with informative conversations about current events and other news that's affecting our business today. For now, we hope you'll share this episode and also subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen. You can look for updates on LinkedIn too. Thanks for listening. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.